the journey never really ends for me, especially, you know, I think we're all students of the instrument forever. We're all students of our craft forever. And I think that's a really good mindset to have in order to continue your musical journey, not chasing perfection, but chasing excellence. And so that's something I really look forward to doing.
This episode contains adult language and adult humor.
Since when have trumpet players ever been considered adults?
If you are easily offended by these types of conversations, consider switching to the oboe. Welcome to the Trumpet Gurus Hang Podcast. I'm your host, Jose Johnson. My guest for this episode is William Leathers. William, well, he's a bit of a trendsetter. A recent graduate of the famed Juilliard School of Music, William is already setting the trumpet world on fire. As the newly appointed principal trumpet for both the Nashville Symphony Orchestra and the Santa Fe Opera, William brings a combination of old world style and modern day swagger to the classical music scene. So, pour yourself a big glass, pull up a chair, and let the hang begin! All right, and here we are back at the Trumpet Gurus Hang, first episode of 2023. Man, can't believe how time has flown. And I am so happy to have as my first guest for the new year, Mr. William Leathers. William, it is a pleasure to finally get to connect with you, my friend.
Pleasure to connect with you too. Yeah, great to be here.
Yeah, I've been following your budding career since your days at Juilliard, a lot of the social media posts you put on, and, you know, always impressed by your playing. And I do have to say, I'm extremely jealous of you. One, you are a phenomenal trumpet player, and two, I used to have hair at one point. really, you know, I see those pictures of you at the big fro, and I'm just like, oh, man. Sucks getting old. So enjoy it while you may, my friend.
Yeah, I got a lot of friends of mine trying to borrow some of it. So
yeah. It's not going to happen, right? All right. Well, you know, and actually that's kind of a good place to start. You do not fit in many ways the prototypical professional, especially principal trumpet player. You just got landed a gig in Nashville's principal trumpet down there. And I definitely want to talk about that a little bit more, but you don't seem to fit the mold that most of us have of what it means to be a professional classical trumpet player. You know, is this something that you've kind of had to deal with over, you know, over your career of kind of being sticking out from the ordinary?
I guess I've had to deal with it in the sense of, in the amount of time that I've been kind of learning how, or just kind of going through my own journey as a musician and as a trumpet player, and, you know, with, piano being my first instrument, you know, my whole journey as a musician and my skill set as a musician and my artistry and whatnot is it's, you know, my own individual musicality, essentially. So you know, obviously when I started at Juilliard, you know, I majored in classical trumpet there. So at that point I considered myself a classical trumpet player, even though I can do other things, but there were some things in my playing, especially in the early years at school, where I felt, you know, there are some things that are a little different that are unique with me, that is actually a great thing for me to have, like different aspects of my playing, but there are some that might not be acceptable in the orchestra world. So there are some things that I have to figure out. So in a sense, yes, I did have to deal with sticking out in that sense. You know, there's sound concept. You have to be able to get your sound to work in an orchestra. If you know, because being able to figure out how to get an orchestral sound and having some you know, high note lead trumpet commercial stuff, whatever, going on as well, you know, that's something I've definitely had to figure out psychologically in order to be the classical trumpet player that I want to be, as well as, you know, stay true to my musicianship and artistry.
Yeah,
that makes a whole lot of sense.
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting because over the past several decades, mm-hmm. you know, you see that you know, in the past there were a whole lot of specialists, and I think that the time of specialization has kind of gone beyond. We've gone beyond that, where, you know, to make a career as a professional trumpet player, it becomes more important to have a varied skill set than just, you know, being, you know, the one trick pony sort of thing. Not that there's anything wrong with being the specialist, but I think that, you know, having that versatility certainly comes in. So when you talk about like being in Juilliard and having, you know, you have the background as a pianist, you have you know, your classical training, you have, you know, your lead playing, your commercial playing, things like that, your own individual kind of concepts of musicality. You know, what are the areas that you think, like, you know, where did like your piano and your lead chops help your classical playing, and where did they perhaps create a little difficulty for you to get over?
That's a great question. Well, I can probably answer that question by just kind of starting from the beginning and taking you through my entire musical journey, in a sense, to kind of speak to where I got certain advantages from for my my classical playing and other sectors of my musical journey, and what I kind of had to work through, kind of the pros and cons of all that. So I started piano when I was 4 years old, and I was inspired to play piano by this big blue cartoon octopus known as Oswald. That's a cartoon I watched growing up. And so Oswald played the piano, and I was watching the show all the time. So I begged my mom for about 6 months for some piano lessons. And then she finally got me some. So that's where the piano journey started. And I still play piano, even though I don't practice as much as I normally would these days, because I'm now I've got a first trumpet gig, and I'm trying not to get fired and all that, you know. So just constantly learning first trumpet parts, trying to stay on top of it. And and so my dad is a trumpet player, and so pretty much all of my childhood before I started the trumpet, I ended up starting the trumpet at 7, but pretty much throughout my entire life before that, I wanted to play the trumpet because of him. And basically, my dad wanted me to start the trumpet when I had the four front adult teeth happening at the front of my mouth, so that it would be a little bit easier to set an embouchure, and so I wouldn't have to, you know, go through starting on the baby teeth and then losing the baby teeth, can't really play properly, and then resetting my embouchure once the adult teeth come in. So as a result, largely I don't think my embouchure has really changed all that much since I first started playing the trumpet. You know, it's just kind of in the same spot. And I've never had braces or anything. So, my dad was my first trumpet teacher, and he's a commercial jazz trumpet player. So that's where that came in. And my dad's sound on the trumpet is really the first sound and the main sound that's still in my head, you know. As long as I can remember, he would be practicing trumpet in the basement every single day for hours and hours. So that's just always been the sound in my head. He basically taught me primarily and consistently up until I was 12 years old. And then when I was 12, my middle school band director, Chris Shigola, he used to be principal trumpet in the Guelph Symphony, which is not too far away from Toronto. And so he took me to a dress rehearsal. I believe it was a holiday show, and it included all sorts of Christmas carols and some selections from the Messiah. And so he brought me to the dress rehearsal, and I got to sit right next to him in the orchestra and just listen and play and listen to all the surrounding music. And I just completely fell in love with what I was hearing and listening to classical 96.3 FM all the time growing up in the Toronto area. It just felt like all that music that I had been kind of consuming all my life just came to life in front of me. And it almost felt like I was a part of it, even though I wasn't contributing a single note in that moment. So I just really fell in love with orchestral playing, or just the orchestra in general. So I started playing in youth orchestra. So I started taking a lot of lessons, basically studying with Chris Shigola from when I was 12 up until I was 17. So at that point, I'm still playing a lot of piano, taking some very serious classical piano lessons. I've got the teaching and influence from my dad, who's a jazz commercial player. And then now I've got my elementary school band teacher, who's a very good orchestral and classical trumpet player, and he can play some jazz too. A very good jazz player. And then so I get to Juilliard, and now I get to study with Chris Martin as my primary teacher. And so that went on. So I studied with Chris alone for my first 3 years at Juilliard. And then I got to the Accelerated Master's Program. So I thought, well, I'm going to be here for 5 years, for a total of 5 years now. So I should probably get some lessons with Ray Mace too. You know, I wouldn't want to miss out on that at all. Chris Martin and Ray Mace really gave me every single possible tool that I could possibly need and beyond that I would possibly need in the orchestral world. So now I've got all this knowledge from my pre-Juilliard childhood and all that, from everything to do with my trumpet studies. And I also got to study with Jim Thompson a little bit when I was in high school. So I got his whole buzzing book method. He directly taught me how to go through all of that and develop my tone quality and connect all my registers and all that. So I have all that knowledge plus what I got from Mr. Martin and Mr. Mace. And so that's basically how that all kind of came together. Essentially, I feel like with all those tools, I was just able to use my own musicality and artistry and intelligence to put that together into who I wanted to be. And of course, you know, from this point on, the journey never really ends for me, especially, you know, I think we're all students of the instrument forever. We're all students of our craft forever. And I think that's a really good mindset to have in order to continue your musical journey, not chasing perfection, but chasing excellence. And so that's something I really look forward to doing. And that's essentially where all of those things happen for me. And in terms of I'm trying to remember your question exactly. I think the only thing I haven't hit is what might have been some challenges for me amongst that. So having piano as my first instrument. So when I was very young, when I was still a piano player, not a trumpet player yet, my dad discovered that I had perfect pitch. And so being a piano player, the perfect pitch was formulated in my brain in concert pitch. And then so when I started on the trumpet and learning all the notes, you know, it kind of came very, very naturally to me at first, just having my dad sitting there, and I would copy what he did. But when it came to reading music on the trumpet, I found it very difficult to read trumpet and B flat parts on the B flat trumpet, because I would see a printed E on the page, and then okay, I have to play an E on the B flat trumpet. I'm not hearing an E. What's going on here? You know, so that was a challenge for me at first. And then so I did this weird thing in my head where I was like, okay, I'm going to read this E on the page, and then I'm just going to think of it as a D, and I'm just going to, you know, I'm going to learn to read the music that way. And I think my brain still kind of works like that when I pick up a B flat trumpet and I play B flat music, and then I do all sorts of weird things when I pick up a C trumpet and play. My transpositional skills are a little bit weird, but I still deal with all of it, and I'm you know, trumpet and F, you know, I can do it, but I don't think I do it like someone without perfect pitch. You know, it's really strange. But eventually I figured that out, and then you know, picking up a D trumpet, an E flat trumpet, and a piccolo trumpet, and A, you know, those were things that were definitely a challenge for me, just because of having perfect pitch in the key of C. Not that I'm complaining about that, you know, I think that can be a huge advantage. The other thing that was also a challenge for me that I discovered probably around the age of 15 and 16 is that my relative pitch, especially when playing with other people, particularly brass players, was pretty awful. You know, having the equal temperament all the time on the piano, and just saying, okay, all the notes are here, just play every note on green. You know, I eventually figured out, you know, I can't really do that. I have to find a way to develop my relative pitch, you know, a lot of intonation skills that people were trying to teach me in different ways. None of those ways were really working for me. So the way I solved that issue, I just went on the internet, looked up a chart as to, you know, where all the intervals lie in terms of how many cents below green you have to go to get your major third in tune and your perfect fifth and so on. And so basically I think about, to this day, I think about the numbers in my head all the time, just to know, have an idea where things are supposed to be, so I can make decisions between straight equal temperament and perfect just intonation and everything in between. Wherever appropriate. So those are essentially a couple of the challenges that I can think of at the moment that have resulted in, or not necessarily resulted in, have come up in my musical journey.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's a whole lot of interesting stuff there. I mean, I really want to dive into some of this stuff, and I hope I can remember all my questions that I have. But what's really interesting is like, you know, when you talk about things like perfect pitch, you know, how, you know, a lot of people like, oh man, I wish I had perfect pitch. You know, and not understanding that there is a liability that exists with that. Because as you said, if you're hearing everything to be exact, you know, then it does become difficult to play with ensembles because of the nature of where certain intervals lie. And if, you know, like practicing with a tuner, I've heard a lot of people say that, yes, you need to practice with a tuner, but you can't rely on the tuner too much, because, you know, when you're on the gig, depending on what you're playing, you know, if the tuning is a little bit different, then what are you going to do? You know, do you play what you hear, or do you play what you need to play? And those can be two different things, as you were saying. So that to me is really a good thing. For people to understand is that perfect pitch helps. My dad had perfect pitch. I do not. I have perfectly bad pitch, actually, is what it is. it's one of those things where everything in life it's got an advantage and it's got a disadvantage, and it becomes how do you manage it. Now, with perfect pitch, one of the interesting things to me is how it manifests itself in you, because everybody kind of has a different way of explaining how they hear. And some people actually, their perfect pitch shows up as synesthesia, which is, when you're hearing, instead of you're hearing, you're maybe seeing or you're feeling or you're smelling or you're tasting. So your senses become, I don't want to say jumbled, but you access a different portion of your brain to process a specific kind of information. So for you with your pitch, is it completely an aural thing, or is there an other kind of physical manifestation of the pitch that goes on in you?
From the base of it, from the base of my perfect pitch, it's an oral thing, but I also have the synesthesia thing on top of it. The colors register along with what I can hear. So there are different colors for different notes. A is red, B is yellow, and C and D are two different greens and whatnot. G is purple. And then B flat is yellow and whatnot. So it's all kind of it's something that's visual along with the audio. And so there's that, and I mean, it helps a little bit with the perfect pitch too, but it's mostly just like a side of fries that comes with hearing, being able to hear what note is being played.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's like, if you're playing and they've got different colored lights going off, is that going to mess with you?
It doesn't really mess with anything. I don't think it causes too many disadvantages. It just looks pretty.
Well, I mean, if you looked at your shirt, what notes are on your shirt right now? No, I'm just kidding. No, but that's
well, there's a lot of animals on my shirt, so they'd be making a whole lot of atonal music. Yeah, well, that'd be a lot of colors.
Yeah. All right. Well, the other thing you were talking about, like your process of keyboard and learning trumpet and the different kind of approaches that you were exposed to, it's a lot of times people where they're looking at your social media posts that you were putting up a few years ago, uh-huh, when you first got into Juilliard, particularly, and you're catching a lot of attention from people. It's like, wow, who is this kid? And such a new wunderkind. He's this natural talent. And granted, there's having perfect pitch certainly is one of those things that becomes a natural talent. However, these are acquired skills that you've gained through your practice. And also the fact that you're in this very rich environment where you had music, where you had access to music, you had access to high level musicians. And so, when you said that you started trumpet at what, six, seven years old?
Yeah, I think I was about to turn seven when I started. Yeah.
And you get to Juilliard, and you are how old when you get to Juilliard?
17.
17. Okay. So 10 years of trumpet, not counting the piano before that. When people see you at first, it's like, oh, overnight sensation. It's like, well, no, this guy's already put in a decade or more of work to get to the point that he's at right now. So, with that environment, and having those advantages, how do you relate then to people who, look at what you do as kind of like, well, you're just a natural. How can you explain to them that while you have certain natural proclivities, that you actually you've had to work to get those skills?
Well, eventually there's a certain amount of talent that I have, but eventually I don't think I'm I don't think I'm by any means like the most talented player, you know, it's like I have some talents and I'll put some work on top of it. But I think at a certain point, even the most talented trumpet player, most talented anything, will run out of talent. So I think there's some hard work required in order to really excel in your craft. So for me, so exhibit A. So I finished high school when I was 16. I was a year ahead. I was a year younger than everyone in my grade most of my life in school. And then I did high school in 3 years. You know, I sped up, did all the coursework, got it done. And then so I basically took a gap year in between high school and Juilliard to just kind of practice and make sure I was ready for all the school auditions that I was going to do. So that's you know, exhibit A. And I really, you know, there was another example. I remember there was an entire summer, I might have been 15 or 16, that I primarily just focused on the Charles Colin Flexibilities book, because I really wanted to be able to just be super fluid in my playing and also be able to play any note on the instrument. The Colin book is probably, I think that's what gave me the ability to get a good double high A finally, which was followed up with the G sharp. I always joke about those notes just because of how horrible high G sharps are for me. I got my double A before I got my double G sharp. Like, it didn't work chromatically for me. It's just, you know, the note that sat better for me, you know, I got. And then, you know, from doing lip flexibilities and then, you know, I also got, I think I got my first like good, rich in tone quality double C from doing that book as well. So, you know, which gave me the ability to do a lot of things. If I can do all that efficiently up to double C, I can have, a nice, efficient high C in the orchestra with a good sound. And then obviously along with that, that gives me a lot of freedom in the lead and commercial trumpet world. Now that I've done the work in the practice room, you know, I can go on and figure a few other things out. What else? I learned the Tomasi when I was 14 or 15. I can't remember, but that you know, took a lot of work. You know, the Tomasi isn't a piece, you know, how much, no matter how much natural talent you have, that you can just properly play, just picking it up. And like, you have to put a certain amount of work in, even if you can kind of do everything on the instrument that's required. You know, there's some stylistic work that goes into that as well. But the Tomasi is a piece that really challenged me and made me a whole lot better, just because when I first looked at the piece, pretty much most of it I couldn't do at first. I looked at it and I said, whoa, there's all sorts of extended techniques that I've never even tried before in here. And the more I worked on each lick in that piece, the better I got at playing the piece, obviously, and the better I got at playing the trumpet. And so there are just all sorts of things that I added to my playing. You know, there were a few natural strengths that I would do my best to enhance, and then there have always been and are still some weaknesses in my playing that I've done my very best to improve on. And that just contributes to my musical journey more and more. And so that continues for the rest of my life as a student of the instrument.
I have to say that you know, your playing has a level of maturity that is rare for someone of your age. But I think even more important than that is you show a level of maturity in your conversations and the way that you, yeah, I mean, not saying that, that you don't have your moments where, you know, you want to be like a young 20 something and let your hair down. I would let my hair down if I had any, you know, it, but the way that you talk about your journey to this point and the way that you articulate your ideas and your acknowledging your strengths and also acknowledging your weaknesses, that's something that it's not as common as one would hope would be in people of all walks of life. And I think that it's as a principal player, particularly, you have to have that balance of the confidence and the ego. You know, ego serves its purpose, but the controlled ego of, you know, I can do this, I'm capable, I'm competent, I've done the work, here it is, with the I don't care what I did 6 months ago, it's about what I can do right now and what I'm going to be able to do going forward, and balancing those two out. So you seem to have that kind of idea that is that good balanced approach to your music and your life. So I'd certainly commend you for that.
Thank you.
And one of the things that I wanted to ask you about in relationship to that is, do you consider yourself to be a structured person, or, you know, someone who has vision, plan, ambition, and you know, clarity of what you want to accomplish in life?
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
I think there's some structure as to what I'd like to do. You know, the common question, where do you see yourself 5 years from now, 10 years from now? I think there are some ideas I have in regards to that, for sure. But I've just always gone by, you know, a bunch of things that my mother has told me growing up. You know, she's been my main motivator all my life, and she's really always instilled a growth mindset in me. She really taught me to have a growth mindset, so that no matter what my passion is or what my gift is or what my dreams are, that there is a way if you really put the work in and you take on challenges with a smile and all that you know, you can do pretty much whatever you want, whatever you dream of doing. And so when I was nine, and I know there's going to be a question regarding my favorite book in the rapid fire questions, but my mother introduced me to this book called Mindset, which is by Carol Dweck. Mm-hmm. And so that's a book where and it talks about a lot of big names who give great example, who are great examples of people with fixed mindsets, where it's like, you know, whatever your gift is, you know, that's your God-given gift, and that's as good as it gets. If you're not naturally good at tennis or whatever, you'll never be good at tennis. And then there's the growth mindset, you know, the Michael Jordans and whatnot, who gets cut from his high school basketball team and still becomes one of the greatest of all time, you know. So that's and I forgot what the question was now.
Well, it's just, yeah, kind of about
something about my structure, right? I think my structure mainly comes from you know, my mom pretty much, and my upbringing in general, both of my parents really.
Yeah. Well, yeah, there's a lot to be said for that. I mean, my mom was a huge influence on me in terms of my approach to life. Actually, I tell the story to my friends a lot that, you know, she gave that conversation to me when I was, I think maybe about 16 or so. And just like, you know, hey, your dad and I try to raise you to be, you know, a good person, teach you right from wrong. You're at that age where you're going to start making decisions about who you hang out with, what you do while you're out, you know, blah, 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 blah. Those are your decisions. And you have to understand that you're going to live by the consequences of those decisions. You know, if you do something stupid, we're going to love you, but you know, you got to deal with it, you know, whether it's, you know, getting a DUI or, you know, having a baby or something like that, that's on you. That is, you know, your responsibility. And so it always made me think twice about doing stuff, you know, and not like, you know, is my mom going to be mad at me? It's like, oh, well, you know, if this does go south, am I willing to, is this an acceptable consequence? Is this acceptable risk that I'm willing to take? And it's not living in fear. It's just living in acceptance of these are all of the potentials, and do I want to put myself in those situations? So, you know, that book by Carolyn Dweck, absolutely one of my favorites. You know, you can outgrow, you can overachieve what anybody thinks your potential is, and you can also
overachieve.
Yeah, and I think that's probably the biggest drawback for people who are considered to be talents or prodigies is that, you know, they rarely live up to their potential because their growth curve is kind of like they start up here and they either plateau or in some cases begin to decline, as opposed to the people who actually have to put in the work, and they kind of the plodders in life who keep doing the work and building on the work. And then they have a slow start, but there's no cap to what they can accomplish because they've learned the skills that are required, the mental and the physical skills and emotional skills that are required to achieve excellence. So I'm big on that stuff, man. That's my jam. So, you know, when you look at yourself right now, you know, as you're looking at your career to this point, not worrying about like the 5-year, 10-year plan sort of thing, but as you're sitting in that principal chair, what do you see as being the greatest accomplishment that you got, you know, in terms of getting the things that you've learned to get you to that point, not just the getting the gig, but what, you know, what do you feel is like, okay, this was the most important thing, the most important lesson I learned that got me to this point?
Wow. Most important lesson that I've learned in all of getting to this point in terms of, and I'm just thinking out loud here because I'm trying to come up with an answer to that, because that's a very interesting question, you know, in terms of where I got to now with the principal chair in Nashville and then principal chair in the Santa Fe Opera as well. You know, that starts next summer for me. And everything else. I don't know. There's a lot of lessons, but I think the main one that I learned a very long time ago from my mother that I'm still reminded of just about every day is and I also know there's going to be a favorite quote question later too, but I'm going to say it now and I'll say it later again. And that quote that my mother told me is, failure to prepare is preparing to fail. And so that basically means, you know, if you don't prepare to get to your goal, you don't set a plan in place, or you have, you know, you've got a performance at the end of the week and you don't prepare and you don't put in the work, then it's not going to be your best performance, for example. And so, and because now I'm in a position where I'm performing all the time, performing several concerts every week. You know, I'm always being reminded just by the work that I'm doing, the work that I continue to put in, that you know, I'm putting in all this preparation so that I can be in the best position possible to succeed. And of course, you know, there's still failure along the way, and that's how we learn. But you know, your best bet at success is being as prepared as you possibly can be.
Yeah.
So I think that would be you know, the greatest lesson that I've learned at this point. And it really, I don't think it really gets much better than that, honestly.
Yeah. Well, that is so true. You know, like, yeah, when we were talking about planning and things like that, you know, one of my favorite quotes is a Mike Tyson quote. You know, everybody's got a plan until they get punched in the mouth. And yeah, I think that's what happens a lot of times, is that the advantage of having clear-cut plans and goals is that you know where you want to be. The problem with that is that sometimes circumstances change, and you know, priorities change, necessities change. So there has to be a level of fluidity. But I think that the attitude that you have about whatever you're doing, prepare, that will never change. That's one of those constants in life. So, you know, I think sometimes it's so easy to get caught in the super specific micro managing of our lives, or trying to do that, as opposed to trying to see the big picture and understand what are the big skills that I need that will serve me as a trumpet player, that will serve me as a parent or a friend or a spouse, or anything that you do in life, and anything that requires any level of skill or ability. There's only one way to do it, and you know, for longevity, and that's to have that kind of that work ethic and the mental approach that you have. So that's good stuff, man. I appreciate that. Love hearing that. So yeah, as you grow in your stature and your exposure as a professional player, you know, all the accolades that we get, and then all of the bennies that come along with that, your Fendi, your red Fendi wear, and all that good stuff. You recently started working with my good friends, Doug McVay and Cookie, at Venture Mouthpieces, to develop a line of mouthpieces, some custom mouthpieces for yourself. And I know we're going to talk about gear a little bit later in the show, but I just wanted to kind of dive into that, because I'm a firm believer in Venture and what they're doing, which is one of the reasons why they're sponsors of the show. And I play their gear as well. But I think that, you know, the thing I love about it is the ability to do that kind of custom work for someone who, you know, if you're a Chris Martin or Wayne Bergeron, or you know, in any of these, you know, top tier players in the commercial or the classical world, yes, you have companies that will, you know, invest in the R&D to develop things for you, but for those of us who are you know, like you, either starting your career, or for me, just, you know, kind of, you know, the in the minor leagues, you know, it's hard to do that, you know, and it's very expensive and time consuming in the traditional way. And I think what Doug and Cookie are doing with Venture makes that accessible. So, you know, can you kind of walk us through like the process that you went through in developing your unique line of mouthpieces, and how that came about, and what your experience has been with that?
Yeah, I can start with how that came about. So just over a year ago, I went to Chicago to attend the wedding of one of my best friends, Logan Wooden. Shout out to Logan. And Logan is also a trumpet player, and he's a trumpet teacher as well, and And he does a bunch of other really great things. And he's also a gearhead just like me, probably even more of a gearhead. I think he knows quite a bit more than me, in fact, about Trumpet gear. And so he basically introduced me to this whole venture thing with the Venkad software. And he showed me, you know, you can have a bunch of mouthpiece references to take a closer look at a mouthpiece that might be your favorite mouthpiece that you've played on for these purposes for years and years that you really like and work very well for your playing, but there are just a few things in that mouthpiece that you would like to change to work a little bit better for you. And then there may be some other mouthpieces in your arsenal that don't exactly match up to your main go-to kind of universal everything mouthpiece that could kind of match up a little bit better. And so the software gives you the ability to create a whole world for yourself where you can have a set of mouthpieces that just work for you for every purpose on that you would need a different mouthpiece for on the instrument. And if you have an idea for a specific mouthpiece, then what you can do is put it together in the software and then have it, if you have a 3D printer, you can 3D print it in resin or whatever plastic of your choice to try it out for very cheap. And if Venture does it for you, that'll only cost you about $25. And so that's a lot cheaper than you know, putting together a whole metal mouthpiece that you don't know is going to work, and then you decide, ah, this isn't really you know, or there are a couple things that I would change about this idea. Like there's a lot less money that goes into that before getting your final metal mouthpiece. And so that's what I really love about Venture and this whole process of developing my line of mouthpieces. And so basically after Logan introduced me to Venture mouthpieces, the first mouthpiece in my collection that came to mind was the GR Wayne Bergeron mouthpiece. And so they're a fantastic mouthpiece. Always loved it for my lead playing, but there are certain things that I would change about it. Not that there's anything wrong with the mouthpiece, but it's, you know, I just feel like this rim could, I could have I just felt like there could always be a way to have a better transition between my orchestra rim and my lead trumpet rim. And I could probably do with a little lower of an alpha angle just so I can have a little more space, maybe mess around with the cup a little bit. And so basically the Venkad software allowed me to do everything that I wanted to do to create a lead mouthpiece, basically the lead mouthpiece of my dreams that I can just put on my face and it works, and I can do everything that I want to do. Kind of put everything that I did in the practice room to work on a piece of equipment with complete freedom. And so I did that. I bought the mouthpiece from Venture and all that, and then basically Doug and Cookie asked if I want to be an artist, and I said, well, absolutely. You know, I think the company is brilliant, and all their technological features are marvelous. And so, and I'm totally on board with it. And I'm currently still in the process with developing the line of mouthpieces. Several of the designs are finished. I think it's going to be about 11 mouthpieces, you know, which which is kind of a lot. But I think every one of those mouthpieces is going to have a very important purpose in my playing, from every style of orchestral playing I will do on a B flat or a C piston trumpet, all of my uses for the E flat trumpet and the rotary trumpet, lead trumpet playing, piccolo trumpet playing, the mouthpieces that I will need for flugelhorn and cornet, and of course a cornet / flugelhorn style mouthpiece that can go into a trumpet that you can play a nice Mahler 3 post horn solo on, or be able to play very quietly with instrumentalists like harpists and whatnot. I just love the idea of having a tool for everything and being able to customize every single last detail myself. And so I have a few of the mouthpieces here. What I also really love about another side note I'd like to make is that I just really love having different names of the mouthpieces, like this one in particular, which is my main one, which I'll use in the orchestra most of the time, and I'll use for other types of playing. I've decided to call it the Universal, and because I've called it the Universal, I've applied names to several other mouthpieces in this line that happen to end with the letters AL, just to kind of have a theme going. There's going to be this Universal. There are two models right here, which are still in plastic, which I'm trying to, make sure work for me. This one's going to be called the Infernal. This one's going to be called the Celestial. And there's all sorts of names. The lead mouthpiece that I developed with them first is called the Zenith, which is just, it doesn't end in AL, but I just wanted it to kind of have the meaning of highest point. And then there's going to be another high note mouthpiece that can be used on the piccolo trumpet and for some commercial playing. If I feel like I need a little bit more volume in the cup, that's going to be called the summit, which technically means the same thing, highest point, high notes. There's one called an ethereal. The rotary mouthpiece is called the Vesperal. You can probably tell I'm really enjoying myself with all this mouthpiece stuff and the names and all that. But that's essentially why I love Venture, and I really appreciate Logan for introducing me, and I appreciate Doug and Cookie for bringing me on board, and I've loved every single second of the process.
Yeah, well, it's I have a love hate relationship with Venkat. Because I love being able to go in and tweak stuff, and I love the flexibility that it gives me, but then I hate it because it gets me into these rabbit holes, and it's like, well, if I just change this and I change that, and it can be kind of crazy. But
everything's good in moderation. You can have so many issues with technology, especially if you're like a C++ software engineer and whatnot. You can spend hours on an issue that you have in coding, or you can spend hours on an issue that you have in your own mouthpiece idea head. It's all a very fascinating journey, and I think it's good in moderation before you get all frustrated with yourself.
Absolutely. So did you do all of the design yourself, or did you get input from Doug or Cookie or any other outside sources on what kind of tweaks you wanted to make?
I've gotten a lot of input from Cookie, and Cookie is also a fantastic cornet and trumpet player himself, and he sounds fantastic on flugel, and he can play some. I think I've seen him play some bass trumpet too. You know, he can do all that. I can't do any trombone mouthpiece stuff, you know, and he can do it all. And so there was, what was it? The carnival model. I didn't talk about that one, but there was a carnival model that I want to do and has turned out great, which is just an kind of an American style cup cornet mouthpiece, which I wanted to be very similar to the Universal, almost the same. And so I sent him the file, and then we had a Zoom call, and he said, "Hey, I just made this modification to the cup, made it deeper. There's more of a V, you know, just because." And I didn't even ask him any questions, just because he's such a master of I guess every sound concept imaginable in the brass band world. And I'm very much not. I don't think I've ever played in a brass band a day in my life. You know, I know a lot about what my sound concept needs to be in the orchestra and in different commercial trumpet situations. But you know, Cookie's such a huge brass band guy. I just said, okay, you know what, I trust you. And then when I tried the mouthpiece on cornet, you know, I said, yeah, I knew he really knew. He knew what he was talking about. So, you know, it's good to get input from him. And I've talked to different players as to what types of equipment they would use for different situations when I was trying to figure out, you know, what do I want to do for my piccolo trumpet playing, or you know, what other options do I want to have for piston trumpet orchestral playing and stuff like that. So various other players as well.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's cool. And you know, just, I love the graphical representation of stuff. I remember back in the old days, when I was a young whippersnapper like you, you know, it was, if you were lucky, there would be a drawing in the product catalog showing the cup size and, you know, the shape of the rim, and yeah, but there's no discussion of things like alpha angles and that. You know, it was just, you know, it's either a cup or a V, yeah, and there you go, and here's your throat size, if you're lucky to get that much information. And now having access to all of not just the more detailed information, but being able to manipulate the variables and see how it creates a different flow. Yeah, I think putting the power in, certainly that there's a level of experience and artistry that's part of the mouthpiece manufacturing process. You know, I have a lot of friends that are in that space besides, you know, Doug and Cookie, you know, and they're great craftsmen and things like that. But I think there's something to be said about having, you know, as the individual, as the artist, as the performer, to get a better grip on what it is that you're using, and to be able to go in and make those kind of tweaks yourself. And like you're saying, you know, but hey, for $25, if I can get a plastic copy of this and see whether it works or not, it makes it much more affordable, and not that the equipment will make you that much of a better player. It just makes it easier for you to be a better player. You know, to, like you said, to get the work that you've done in the practice room helps it to come out of the horn without as many restrictions as sometimes, you know, having gear that's good enough. Yeah, as opposed to what's really what you need. And we're going to talk about gear more in a few minutes, but I'm just so happy for you, man, and looking forward to seeing all of the wonderful contributions that you make to the mouthpiece world with your line of 60 million mouthpieces. Do you have a shoe collection like that too? I mean, are you one of those guys that shoe for every occasion?
I don't have a huge shoe collection, but I have a few different colored pairs of shoes that go with some of the different colors and flashy suits that you'll see me wearing. I got a I got a pair of red shoes that go with the red jacket. I got a pair of shiny pink shoes that go with the pink jacket and so on. So, but it doesn't get nearly as nerdy as the mouthpiece stuff.
well, maybe someone will design or develop a VanCAD for shoes, and you can like custom make your arches and the heel size and shapes and.
Yeah, there you go. Don't let Nike steal that idea.
Yeah, I said it here first, Nike. So before we get moving on to the final portions of the show, I just wanted to ask you one other question, and it's about your gig now in Nashville. There's mm-hmm. a lot of great players in Nashville, so many great players. A lot of my good friends down there, Jose Sabaja, Vinny Chachelski, Tyler Yeager, Rob Qualick. I've got a lot of friends down in that area. When you audition for that gig, I mean, the audition process, that's something I've talked to a few people about. And you've gone through the audition, obviously, getting to Juilliard. You did this audition and you nail, right out of college, you nail a great principal gig. Other than the fact that you put in the practice and to develop the skills to get you the job, I do understand there's a level of mental preparation that's involved in preparing for a major audition of that type. So what did you do other than, just shedding on your horn? What did you do to prepare yourself for that audition? And specifically, what kind of advice would you give to trumpet players out there that are either getting ready to audition for a university or a program, and the ones that are looking to get into a pro situation, what kind of advice would you give them to be in the best possible position to be prepared for success in their audition?
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Well, one of the most important lessons that I learned myself in that whole process of getting ready for the Nashville audition and a bunch of other auditions is the importance of listening to recordings of great players and great orchestras and so on and so forth, and playing along with those recordings. Playing along with several recordings of the same piece as well, as a matter of fact, so you can take aspects of different great players playing and just glue it all together and stick your name on it and just have that all in your arsenal. It's a much faster way of learning than trying to do it without looking at the music and playing and thinking through, what can I do with this? There are already so many ideas out there that I've been out there for years and years and years that you can really use to your advantage. So in particular for my preparation for the Nashville audition, I had a playlist with every excerpt on the list in orchestral context with, all fantastic recordings. A whole lot of New York Phil, with Phil Smith on there. Phil Smith's one of the all-time greats, and he's got one of my favorite trumpet sounds. Just having all those in context, putting it together in Logic Pro for myself so I can have it fade in at the beginning and fade out, so it's a smooth listen over the course of my practice session. And then I just put it in my iTunes or my and have it on my music app on my phone. And all I gotta do most of my practice session is getting ready for in the early to middle stages of the preparation process. For me, most of my practice sessions will just consist in me putting on the headphones, you know, full thing over the left ear and off the right ear, so I can listen to myself play. Just hit shuffle, open the music, and keep playing along. And then I found that to be kind of the most efficient way for me to really get ready to go and win my first job, because I wanted everything musically, technically, stylistically, and just being able to you know, go from one piece to one that's contrasting to that previous piece, just like that. And you know, hitting shuffle on the playlist I think that was the most efficient way for me to go about at the time. And I still do, you know, a lot of that type of listening. But I felt like that was the most efficient way for me to learn a list of that capacity in the amount of time that I had. And just, you know, my advice would be listening and playing along with your favorite recordings, so you can absorb as much of that as possible, because all the people you're listening to have won some really great some really great jobs, and they become the figures that they are, and some of the greatest musicians of all time for a reason. So I think they're all very important to study.
All right. That sounds good to me. All right. Well, we're going to get on to our regular segments. And this year, this episode, I'm going to introduce a new segment. And this segment is brought to us by Airflow Music and my good friend Brian Davis. And this is called Go Practice. And Go Practice is about that, about your experiences, your knowledge, you know, your tips for practice. And I just want to maybe just go with this one concept for you to maybe just talk about a little bit. As a professional, you know, there's a big difference between being a college student, you know, as you're in Juilliard doing, you know, where your job was to practice, more or less. And being a professional where your job is to play. So there are times in our lives, whether it be because of demands of our professional playing career or the demands of, you know, if you're a part-time player or a semi-pro player or amateur player, the demands of your life don't always give you that ability to spend 6-8 hours a day practicing. What tips could you give people to be able to maximize their practice time? If you've got a limited amount of time, what is the approach that you like to take to make sure that you get the most out of the amount of time that you have available for you for practice?
I think for me, when my time is very limited, honestly, I think I do the very best I can to prepare efficiently for what I need to do. You know, if I have a performance at the end of the week and I don't have a whole lot of time to prepare, and that there are all sorts of things that I would also normally do in my practice, like the James Thompson buzzing book method and flexibility exercise, articulation exercises and etudes here and there and whatnot, then that week I'll just do the very best that I can to as I prepare to be, you know, 100% ready for the performance at the end of the week. I try to get everything I can technically and musically from the music that I'm practicing to get ready for, so I can almost make up for all of the all the other stuff in my practice session that I would normally do that I didn't get to do that week, and may hopefully learn something in the process in all those categories in terms of music and technique and style and all that.
All right. So, but I'll make this a part of the ongoing thing, a keep it or cut it. So if there's one thing that you absolutely feel like you have to do anytime you practice, what is it? And if there's one thing that if you get to it, you get to it. And if you don't, you don't. What would that be?
I think that would be, I every day I always do something from the James Thompson buzzing method. Whether I do like 1 to 4 slowly and properly with the recording, or I just kind of blow my way through it very quickly. You know, I always like to just go through the process of starting on the mouthpiece, finding where my middle G F concert on a B flat trumpet is vibrating and resonating and all that. And to take myself through the registers. I think that would be it. Some type of form of a couple of James Thompson buzzing basics.
All right. I like it. Good. All right. Let's move on to our next segment. And our next segment is called Sound Offs, brought to us by Michael Barkley of Barkley Microphones. It's about your approach to sound, and we've talked about it kind of in passing. Yet you're just talking about using the mouthpiece buzzing for finding your resonant center of your pitch. What other things do you think are critical for a trumpet player to think about, understand, or practice in order to make the most resonant and beautiful sound they can on the horn?
I think one of the major things, you know, that going back to the Thompson method, I think one of the major keys with that is building habits for yourself, building habits for yourself physically in terms of how your body functions when you're trying to make the most beautiful resonant sound. And that kind of just comes with repetition, and that covers the physical side of things. I think Jim Thompson told me one time, I think he either told me it takes 4 to 6 weeks or 6 to 8 weeks to build a habit. And so that requires a whole lot of repetition. So that covers the physical side of things, which is really mental, but then the result of that is everything is physically there for you. In terms of the psychological side of things, which I would classify as, where your ear is when you're trying to find your sound for different purposes. If you want to have an orchestral sound for a certain type of repertoire, whether it's Brahms or Mahler or Bruckner or Ravel or whatever it is, I think it's really important, and going back to that idea of listening to recordings and just having that idea in your ear, even if you're completely unable to explain to yourself or explain to anyone what it is that audible concept is. And I think it's really important to just have it psychologically ingrained in yourself so that you can really use your all of your recording studying and your and all the physical repetition that you've done in the practice room to your advantage, so you can create the sound that you want in all circumstances at all times.
All right. Solid advice. All right. Now let's move on to our discussion of gear. It's Geared Up, brought to us by Venture Mouthpieces. Venture, where technology, craftsmanship, and design intersect. Use the code TrumpetGurus21 at checkout to get 10% off of your order. And you can maybe order one of William's new signature line mouthpieces to give them a try.
Coming soon
to an online store near you. So this is about gear. And, you know, we're going to talk about the mouthpieces and your 11 mouthpieces. but because of, you know, the nature of what you do as a classical musician, you have to have a lot of different gear. And so when you're looking at having all of those different horns, how do you approach gear? And like, what is your suggestion to people that have to have a variety of gear? How do you manage to get a level of consistency and familiarity in spite of all the diversity that you need in the gear that your job demands of you?
I think you just have to check off some boxes for yourself individually, because there are different pieces of equipment that will work for others in terms of how their face works physically, how their air flows, the way you use your tongue and all that. So that would be the physical side of things, like what size mouthpiece is going to fit your face, and how does your venturi and lead pipe and bell flare need to be shaped in order to match the way your air flows. And then that goes into psychologically, you know, how does that aid the sound concept that you have up here? Because if you have a B flat trumpet that is considered to be physically one of the most efficient instruments, like if you have some type of lead trumpet that would, you know, you can play any note on and it comes out efficiently, zero response time and whatnot, you know, that might, depending on what your sound concept is, if you're looking for a big Phil Smith Bach 37 sound, for example, you know, that might not be psychologically the most efficient thing for you. Eventually, if you're trying to get a different sound than what your equipment tends to facilitate, then that's not really efficient at the end of the day. So I think efficiency is a big thing, and there just has to be a very healthy balance between a player's needs physically and a player's needs psychologically, coming from the ear altogether.
All right. Yeah. And I love that idea of efficiency, because, you know, efficiency doesn't necessarily mean, like, when we tend to think about efficiency as trumpet players, we do think about it like in that lead trumpet kind of world, you know, like, you know, least amount of air, the most, you know, most projection, yeah, blah, 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 blah. But like you said, while that might be good in one area, it actually is inefficient in another area. So, you know, it's what's going to give you the best chance of doing what you hear and feel with the least amount of effort. That is efficiency. So,
right, absolutely. And another example of that applies specifically to myself is, you know, for an orchestral style mouthpiece that I would use, I tend to use a very large rim, probably something of the size that you would find on a Bach 1X. And you know, I've played on that size for a while, and I've experimented a little bit with going smaller and seeing if that can work in the orchestra. But what I kind of discovered over time is what was really most efficient for me was that large size. Because if I go smaller than that, then from a physics standpoint, yes, it is more efficient for executing what I, you know, the execution side of things in on the job in the orchestra. But psychologically, what will start to happen for me is I'll start to unconsciously try to to recreate all the things that were happening on the bigger mouthpiece that I can't do on the smaller mouthpiece anymore. And then I'll get tired quicker on a three rim than I would on a one rim. So it's actually far more efficient for me to figure out how to play efficiently, or not figure out. I've already, you know, mostly figured out, and I'm still figuring out how to, you know, not figure it out, but know how to play efficiently on a one rim than, you know, just play efficiently on a three rim, for example.
Yeah. There you go, folks. That's golden information. All right. And time to wrap things up with our final portion as our Robinson's Remedy rapid fire round, as William well knows. And I've been debating whether I want to, since you already are prepared, whether I want to give you the standard questions or whether I want to switch you up to the auxiliary questions. So we'll go standard. We'll see what you say.
Whatever works.
All right. We'll go with the standard, because I just want to see what you have to say, what you have prepared. So, all right, do you know the
deal? Well, it's not like I studied or anything. It's just that, you know, I've watched a few of your episodes, and I just happen to know what some of the questions are, and you know what other it was nice to hear other people's answers and whatnot. So, you know, that's all it is.
Okay. All right. Yeah. You weren't cramming or anything like that. No crib notes. Okay, all notes down, phones off. All right, here we go. Like being in college again. All right, first question for you. Who's the biggest influence in your life that's not a trumpet player?
I think that would be my parents. You know, I've talked about my mom a lot in terms of being my main motivator in life. And then my dad is as the first trumpet sound.
Yeah. All right. What's your favorite book?
Mindset by Carol Dweck.
All right. What's the worst movie you've ever seen?
That I can't really name. I'm not really much of a movie person, so I haven't seen a bad movie, and I don't know how to really critique movies to that degree.
Okay. Yeah. If you weren't a trumpet player, what would you want to be?
If it was another instrument, piano, since that's my first instrument, and then if not something in music, an actor would be cool.
All right. What's your favorite drink?
Diet Coke.
All right. You can have a dinner party. Invite any three living people. Who would you want to have there?
I would love to see, and I would love to have Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump, and Anderson Cooper, just so I could see all that debating done over again. I think that would be an entertaining evening. Just sit back with the popcorn and have at the entertainment.
Oh, that would be great. Or it could be the worst movie you've ever seen. One of the two. I'm not sure which one it would be.
Exactly.
At your table, you have three additional chairs. Any three people from history?
Muhammad Ali, Wilt Chamberlain, and Bud Hersett. I think that'd be a funny evening.
Yeah. Okay. Lacquer, plated, or raw?
Plated.
What is your favorite quote?
Failure to prepare is preparing to fail.
What's your greatest fear?
Checking my horns going on a plane.
that is a bad one. You could be granted one superpower. What would it be?
Be able to fly, so I don't have to check my horns.
There you go. What aspect of trumpet playing do you feel is the most overrated?
I did think about this one for a while, actually, after watching a couple episodes, but after thinking about it, I'm thinking, you know, I feel like every skill on the trumpet, becomes, you know, not so overrated in different genres of music, you know, so it's hard to really. Hard to really name, but I feel like I'm not really going to make a whole lot of money playing a double high C in the orchestra typically, but so that can be an overrated skill there, but not so much in other genres of music. So that's just one example.
All right. So situational.
Yes.
All right. What aspect do you feel is the most underrated?
I kind of have the same answer, honestly. You know, it's hard to really say. You know, things become more, and some things become more important, some things become less important in different situations.
Okay. You could go back in time, 16 years, and give yourself one piece of advice about music. What would it be?
Listen to more recordings.
All right. And you're going to give your younger self one piece of advice about life.
Continue to do what you're doing and don't have any regrets.
All right. Final question for you, William Leathers. What do you want your legacy to be?
I was a happy guy who made other people happy and was able to inspire others.
All right. Well, that is a good one. And you're certainly well on your way for that. So just keep doing what you're doing, man. So I appreciate you taking the time. I know, we've been trying to get this together for some time, and I'm just glad everything worked out. The timing worked out to do this and to have you as my first guest for 2023. Again, I'm so impressed by your skills as a trumpet player, but also your attitude in life. I mean, you are wise beyond your years, my friend. So I'm truly looking forward to following your career. And hopefully when I get down to Nashville to visit, I can catch up with you and buy you a Diet Coke.
Absolutely. That'd be great. Yeah. This has been a huge pleasure. Thanks so much.
Oh, absolutely. My pleasure. And as always, folks, thank you for joining us for another episode of The Hang. And like, subscribe, share. Make sure you support our sponsors. All of them are great people. They're great trumpet players, and they're super interested in just helping to see the trumpet community grow and improve. So make sure you check them out. And next time you're looking for equipment, definitely look them up. So folks, until the next time, a piece inside Greece. We out.
Thanks for hanging with us today. This podcast is all about creating deeper connections through our mutual love of music and the trumpet life. Make sure you subscribe to this podcast and also like and share this episode with a friend. We want to see The Hang grow for show. Please support our sponsors and consider becoming a personal supporter of this podcast as well. Remember, for less than the price of a bottle of valve oil a month, you can keep this podcast moving smoothly. The Trumpet Guru's Hang is recorded at The Candy Factory, a co-working space and social club located in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Jose Johnson is the executive producer. Post-production editing is by Mitch Bowers. Our opening theme song was composed and performed by Lexi Signor. And our closing theme music comes courtesy of The Greatest Funeral Ever. Incidental music is by Ethan Swayze and Jose Johnson. Graphic design by Ann Kirby of The Sweet Corps. The Trumpet Guru's Hang podcast is produced in collaboration with the So Good Lancaster Media Group.